She'd had plenty of time to think the past few days, and she'd come to the conclusion that her dad and Renzo had been right to question her motives. This crazy goose chase to figure out her lineage was, in fact, a way to avoid dealing with who she really was, and the misguided effort had left her drained and lost. She hadn't spoken to Jack since the disastrous conversation about the DNA testing, but she planned on heading down to the shore next weekend to make peace and apologize. Better to do so in person.
"Where did you go? I need help with this."
Melinda's voice cut through Bailey's fog of thoughts. Right. The drawer pulls for the kitchen cabinet still needed to be picked out. They'd headed to Simon's Hardware on 3rd Avenue early so that Melinda could make it to Fred's office by 11. Bailey pointed to a couple of options that she thought might work, but didn't push back when Melinda chose lime green plastic ones instead.
"And I forgot to tell you, Fred wants you in the room at the meeting today."
A shard of guilt-induced panic sliced through Bailey. "Why?"
"No idea. Maybe he wants you as a witness, since you were there when we found everything. Tony will be there as well."
When Bailey found everything, she didn't bother to correct her. Great. One more humiliation to suffer through. Then again, in the past couple of weeks, Melinda had been more than kind. Probably felt sorry for her dirt-poor, messed-up cousin, and she even suggested Bailey stay on for a couple of months in the guest room. But Bailey knew where that road lay. Mornings of waking up to wine glasses piled up in the sink and a coating of white powder on the Lucite coffee table. Bailey's life had been artificially propped up post-rehab, as the Dakota had become her refuge from the storms that raged outside its thick walls. It was time to move on with her life and start over again. And for the first time in years, she had a plan, instead of blowing wherever the wind took her. She'd found a fifth-floor walk-up apartment in the West 80s that would be available next month, and sweet-talked the landlord into giving her first dibs. Once Melinda's job was completed, she'd sign up at a temp agency and answer phones or type letters, whatever it took to support herself and pay off her debt to Tristan while she cultivated clients for her new business, Bailey Camden Design. The waiting room of Fred's office offered a floor-to-ceiling view north. Bailey stood close to the glass, taking in the expanse of the landscape, from New Jersey to the Bronx to Long Island, while Tony and Melinda gabbed on about the upcoming party, their voices too loud for the hushed environment. The elevator opened and a man stepped out, looking completely out of place. He wore a ratty denim jacket, and the lower half of his face was covered in a bushy ginger beard. But the eyes were the same celestial blue as Melinda's.
"Manville!"
Bailey went and gave him a big hug. He smelled of leather and peppermint. She'd always enjoyed spending time with Melinda's twin, even though most often his sister would insist they play hide-and-seek and then run off to the roof of the Dakota, leaving him behind. But now that Bailey knew she and Manville shared a connection with Kenneth, and that Manville had found refuge in his downstairs apartment, she felt closer to him than to Melinda.
"How are you?"
"I'm fine."
He scratched at his beard.
"Can't wait to get out of here and head south again, though."
Melinda gave him a cursory hug and introduced him to Tony.
"Sorry to drag you back to the big bad city, my shaggy brother, but we had some excitement, and I figured you'd want a piece of the action."
Manville shook his head.
"Action's not my thing. This is all for you, sis."
Melinda purred with delight.
"Well, thank you for that."
"No thanks necessary. I knew you would have showed up in Montgomery and drawn my blood yourself if I didn't do your bidding."
"You know me so well. Now, here we are together again, about to get the results that tell us if we're rich or really rich."
The receptionist spoke, her voice a whispered rebuke.
"He'll see you now."
The group awkwardly maneuvered through the door of Fred's office in order of rank. Melinda, Tony, Manville, then Bailey.
"Uncle Jack?"
Bailey's father sat in the same chair Bailey had been in a few weeks ago. He was dressed in the suit he'd worn at her mother's funeral. including the tie that Bailey had chosen for him in tears, trying to avoid looking at her mother's clothes in her parents' walk-in closet. Melinda looked over at Fred.
What's going on?
Bailey gnawed at her thumbnail, a childish habit she'd thought she'd shaken. Her father was here, so he must have done what she'd asked. But why? This made no sense.
Please, take a seat, everyone, directed Fred.
Bailey hunkered down into a love seat against the wall, feeling like an imposter, while Melinda took the chair next to Bailey's father. Tony perched on the arm of the sofa, arms crossed, and Manville stood near the door, as if eager to escape as soon as he possibly could.
Why is Uncle Jack here?
Demanded Melinda. Fred cleared his throat before answering.
I wanted to make sure all parties were present.
All parties?
I hope everyone will keep in mind that while we have some answers, this matter is far from settled, as the provenance of the sheath is murky, to say the least. Others may come forward and try to claim it, as well as the knife.
What others? Asked Melinda.
The Tibetan government, descendants of anyone who might have owned it before it came into the Rutherford's possession, for example.
Tony waved his hand.
That was hundreds of years ago. Never mind about that. What are the test results?
Fred opened up a file on his desk and then peered at them over his reading glasses.
The lab in England did extensive testing on the finger bone and what they could of the blood residue. The genetic line was then traced using Y-DNA technology, meaning along the male line. If there was no match, the sheath would not be considered part of the Camden family estate and would become property of the Dakota Cooperative.
Right. And what did you find out?
Melinda spoke to him as if he were 12. Fred looked up from his notes.
The co-op has no claim to the sheath.
Melinda yelped.
Fantastic! I knew Renzo was talking bullshit. Now we can have him fired.
She turned around to Bailey.
I know you like him, but he should never have meddled. He's toast.
Not so fast.
Fred held up one hand and swallowed, his Adam's apple bobbing above his silk tie.
It's not your property either, Melinda.
What the hell does that mean? Whose is it then?
Fred looked straight at Bailey.
It's Jack Camden's.
Melinda swiveled around and regarded Bailey and Jack the way a python might a mouse.
They weren't part of the testing process.
As a matter of fact, Jack was.
Fred turned the paper on his desk around so she could see the results.
And Jack Camden is a match to both the blood evidence and the bone.
Bailey felt like she was sinking into quicksand, and not just because the couch seemed to be swallowing her whole.
That was not part of the deal,
Melinda screeched. She turned to Jack, eyes bulging.
How the hell did your blood get added to the test results?
What did you do?
Tony glared at Bailey. Bailey squirmed forward and tried to sit upright, but the cushion on the love seat was too soft. She sank back and tried to find her voice.
I told Fred what I'd found. He said that it had to be done through the male line, so I asked my dad, but he said no.
Fred jumped in.
As a matter of fact, this was not entirely Bailey's doing. I was intrigued by the evidence she presented, and it led me to review the old files. As we've represented the family for over 100 years, the archived documents were still in existence. I discovered a letter in the files dated from 1900 from Minnie Camden, stating that she wished to set up an annuity for Christopher Camden when he turned 21, but she died before it was established.
Christopher had been considered part of the family. He hadn't been intentionally cast out. Bailey let out a deep exhale, not realizing she'd been holding her breath. Fred continued on.
That, along with the evidence presented by Bailey, convinced me to request a DNA sample from her father for testing.
She stared at the back of Jack's head. he'd done it after all. She wished he'd turn around and look at her so she could get a sense of what he was thinking. Was he still furious with her for foisting the truth on him? Melinda's nostrils flared.
We did not agree to pay for that. You were not allowed to pay for this scavenger hunt with money from the trust.
I paid for it myself.
Jack's deep baritone rumbled around the room like thunder. Bailey remembered that voice, the one he used when neighbors stopped by to give their condolences after her mother had died. He'd sent them away, casseroles in hand, while Bailey hid up in her room. Yet Fred's announcement couldn't be right. If Melinda and Bailey were related, both sides of the family would match. If Bailey wasn't related to Theodore Camden, Melinda would match and Jack would not. Those were the only outcomes Bailey had considered.
You bitch!
Melinda looked like she was about to swallow Bailey whole.
That's enough now.
Fred jabbed a finger at the papers on his desk.
You signed a document to abide by the results. There was nothing amiss.
Melinda's oversized hoop earrings swung with each turn of her head, to Bailey, then back to Fred.
So now Bailey and her father get the sheath?
Bailey didn't care about the sheath. She'd wanted to be part of a legacy, to feel some connection with her past. Still, it was worth it to see the look on Tony and Melinda's faces. Take that for desecrating the family apartment. Tony went white.
This isn't only about the sheath, though, is it?
The earrings swung again in Tony's direction.
What do you mean?
This means that Bailey and her father get the trust, not you or Manville.
Melinda leaped up, towering over them all in her 4-inch heels.
That's not true. I'm the great-granddaughter of Theodore Camden. Manville and I are due our trust in 2 days when we turn 30. That's the way it's always been. This doesn't change anything.
Fred spoke succinctly, clearly.
This changes everything. The trust states that it's solely for descendants of Theodore Camden by blood. Neither you nor Manville are. Therefore, it's no longer your rightful property, Miss Camden.
Bailey looked over at Manville, who had a wide grin on his face. He seemed amused by the turn of events, or at least at his sister's indignation.
Who am I, then?
Melinda looked blindly around the room.
If Theodore Camden isn't my great-grandfather, who the hell is?
Fred refused to rise to her level of aggression.
Sometimes we don't know the answers. It was a long time ago.
Melinda squawked a few times before finding her voice.
We will fight this, won't we, Tony? We'll hire a lawyer and fight this. I don't care what I signed or what the DNA says. I know who I am.
Tony's eyes shifted back between Fred and Melinda. Never one to hide his feelings well, Bailey could tell he was adding up the cost of the renovations he'd paid for, as well as all the other loans he'd probably extended Melinda this past year.
We will fight it,
Melinda repeated, less emphatically this time.
After all, it was your stupid idea to get the DNA testing in the first place, Tony. You owe me that at the very least.
Fred cleared his throat.
There is good news, however.
What's that?
Snapped Melinda.
The Dakota apartment remains yours and Manville's. It's outside the trust, so you both own a considerable asset.
Great! A stinky apartment in the shitty part of town. Thanks a lot.
Melinda grabbed her purse and stomped out. Before she left the room, she leaned over Bailey, who was still wedged in the couch.
You'll be sorry for this. For meddling? After everything I've done for you? I will take you down so fast you'll end up in the streets begging for handouts.
Tony followed her, calling for her to wait for him. Bailey took another deep breath, letting the air clear from all the arguing and harsh words. Melinda, even with all her faults, had been a friend, and the only one who'd stuck by her after rehab, and the injustice of the revelation stung. She'd have to find a way to make this right. She heaved herself to the edge of the couch and sat there, numb.
So, my dad and I are the heirs?
Fred smiled.
Yes, the way the trust works, the money goes to your father, and then, upon his death, to you.
Manville sat beside her and patted her on the back.
Congratulations, Bailey. Nice detective work.
I didn't mean for you and Melinda to lose everything. Your trust, your identity.
You kidding? I'm happy to take off the mantle of being a Camden. Never meant much to me to begin with. Maybe I'll invent a new name, like Bowie did.
Jack rose, extending his hand.
We really should make up for it. Include you in some way.
We can donate to your outsider artists, offered Bailey.
Manville stood and shook Jack's hand, covering it with his own.
It's not about money, what they do. And I've learned a lot from that. These artists want to create art because they've got an image or idea in their head, and it just has to get out. They paint it or turn it into a giant mobile of scrap metal. But it comes from in here.
He tapped his head.
They don't care about furthering their careers or making a ton of cash.
A wave of tenderness swept over Bailey. Kenneth is so proud of you, everything you've accomplished.
You've met Kenneth? I'm stopping by to say hello before I head out. Can I tell him the news?
Sure. Will you be staying at the apartment while you're in town?
Nah, it's not my home anymore. Never really was. I prefer life on the road. I like that,
said Jack.
Hey, I consider myself an outsider artist, working on cars all day. It's its own kind of art.
Manville poked him in the chest, giddy.
That's it exactly, man.
He thanked Fred for his time before hitching his backpack over one shoulder and sauntering out. After he'd left, Bailey and Jack took the seats across from Fred's desk. Manville was right. The news of actually being a Camden was bittersweet, considering the awful legacy of the family. She addressed Fred, avoiding her father's eyes. How are Melinda and Manville not part of the family? I figured if I was related, we'd all be able to share the trust. Who are they, then? The photo of Sarah and the children took on new significance with these revelations.
As I said to her, it's one of those mysteries we may never solve.
It pained Bailey to think that they might never know the full story. What exactly had happened between Theodore Camden and Sarah Smythe? Bailey imagined the woman had been sent over the edge by her love to a married man, and that after her release from Blackwell's, she'd bided her time before killing the man she considered responsible. But no doubt, there was more to the story. I think the Met should have the sheath, she said. Jack nodded in agreement but didn't say anything. Learning the truth seemed to have alienated the one family member she had left. What had she done? Fred made a note on his desk.
Very well, I'll let them know.
I'm sorry I lashed out at you, Dad.
Bailey's eyes welled up with tears, and she was glad Melinda was gone, so as not to see her so vulnerable.
I know I forced you into this, that you don't want to be a part of this family, what's left of it. But I swear, I don't care if the trust is worth $2,000 or $20,000. That's not why I did it. I had to know the truth.
Jack spoke slowly, carefully.
After I heard from Fred, I spent a long time sitting out in the docks, thinking. I figured I'd held you and your mom back, nursing the same grudge that had driven my father mad all those years. Watching as it affected you, too, like a poisonous birthright passed down from generation to generation. I'm sorry I closed myself off and did nothing to help you. I didn't know what to do, or what to say to make it right.
He tilted his head, one eyebrow raised.
And, of course, Scotty told me I was out of my mind to pass up a potential windfall.
She took his hand in her own. Thanks for covering the cost of the testing. Let's just hope the trust has enough to reimburse you. Fred laughed.
Oh, I don't think you'll find that a problem. How happy I am to spread some good news today.
His features relaxed for the first time since the meeting had begun.
You are now in charge of $3 million.
Bailey yelped.
$3 million?
Jack blinked a couple of times.
I'm not sure I'm capable of handling that much money. Don't worry, we're here to help, offered Fred. You'll get all the guidance and advice necessary.
Jack turned to Bailey.
First off, I want you to consider it our money. Yours and mine. We'll make decisions together. Promise?
She promised. And second?
Let's take care of each other better.
The words came out a hoarse whisper.
Your mother would have wanted that.
Bailey buried her face in his chest and wept.
Chapter 31. New York City, November 1885. Blackwell's Island. The one place to which Sarah vowed she'd never return. But it was the only way of reclaiming her own past, of finding out the truth. All the strange dreams and ruminations of the past few weeks had gnawed away at her, and it was time to close out that chapter in her life for once and for all. If Daisy had been wrongly accused, Sarah would make things right. Only by seeing the girl's face would she know. She almost didn't recognize the asylum, if it weren't for the familiar octagon. The land to the right of the walkway had been transformed into a garden, where dozens of women in serviceable dresses and aprons weeded and chattered away in the unexpected November warmth, clearing the flower garden for the winter to come, and picking large gourds that they put onto a wheelbarrow. Sarah walked past the building, to the south end of the island, clutching the piece of paper that Nellie had sent her. Her friend had responded quickly to Sarah's request, and for that she was grateful. Sarah had informed her of her trip today, so someone knew where she was. Part of her regretted not accepting Nellie's invitation to accompany her, as she had a not-so-irrational fear that she might once again disappear into the madhouse. But Nellie was a journalist. Sarah didn't want to let on too much. Not yet. In the penitentiary, Sarah waited in a dingy room with scuff marks on the walls, Nellie's referral having created an immediate response to her request. The door opened, and Daisy shuffled in behind a woman guard, wearing a stony expression.
"You have 10 minutes, the guard said before walking out.
Daisy scowled at Sarah. Her hair, once shiny with curls, was a matted, dirty nest. Two of her teeth were missing, and it made her seem even younger than she was, like a 7-year-old, albeit one who was chained by hands and feet. She sat down hard in the chair opposite Sarah.
Daisy.
Sarah leaned forward, near tears. Daisy considered her for a moment. Then she sneered and spit on the ground. Sarah drew back, repulsed. She'd imagined the girl pouring out her heart, telling her that she was innocent, pleading for help. Anything but this cold grimace. She didn't know how to begin, what to say. In spite of the curl in Daisy's lip, she recognized in her eyes a desperation to make contact. Sarah had felt the same way in the asylum, the animal need to communicate with someone else, about anything, to find a measure of humanity in the rigid structure of each day. She began again.
Daisy, what happened to your teeth?
Got knocked out. That's the very least of my worries, trust me.
Are your brothers and sisters all right?
Dunno.
She kicked the leg of the chair with her heel.
I think you know why I'm here. I want to find out what exactly happened last year.
Why should I tell you?
Because we were friends once. I want to understand. I need to understand.
Daisy's tone softened. You sure about that? Sarah remained quiet, letting the silence between them grow. For what seemed like ages, the only sound was the wind. Finally, Daisy sighed, her body caving in on itself.
Mr. Douglas should have come through with what you asked for after my mum died.
I'm sorry he didn't.
Then I wouldn't have been so desperate.
Sarah leaned forward.
You never let on that something was wrong.
Because there was nothing you could have done about it, obviously. You'd tried and failed. Stupid Seamus. Christmas Eve, he got himself put in jail for pickpocketing, and I had to get him out, to take care of the wee ones. I borrowed a large sum, and then had to figure out how to pay it back. There was no choice in the matter.
No choice about what?
She stuck out her chin, defiant.
I told Mr. Camden that you were with child, and said that if he didn't pay me, I'd tell his wife.
No. Daisy was lying. Theo couldn't have known about Sarah's pregnancy all along. That couldn't be correct. Poor Daisy. All her talk of marrying a wealthy man, her infatuation with rising above her station, had turned her into an ugly, wretched person.
Don't look at me like that!
Daisy's voice was a menacing growl.
You have no idea what it's like to feed that many mouths.
She'd test her.
In that case, what did Mr. Camden do when you told him?
He grew silent for a while. Said that he was in a bind, that there was nothing he could do, but something had to be done. He paced about and grew upset, and then I had an idea. I offered to take care of it, and then he would pay me for my trouble. Solve both our problems.
Theo had been waiting on Hardenberg's approval at that time. Any scandal of a mistress or a baby would have ruined his chances of starting his own business. Dread brewed in her gut.
What did you do?
I thought it'd be as easy as taking you to see the doctor, but you kept on putting it off. So then I took a bottle of something that the doctor gave my mother when she was in your situation. I added it to that tonic you drank.
She remembered those weeks before she was taken away. The lack of focus, not being able to remember what she was doing one day to the next.
What did you give me?
Daisy shrugged.
Dunno. I felt bad, watching you reel about, get sick, and the first installment of Seamus's debt was due. So I nicked the necklace from Mrs. Camden. It's easy in a big apartment house, where lots of people are always coming and going. Figured I'd sell it and be done with it. But no one would take it.
A flash of irritation crossed her face.
Seamus said I was adult, stealing something so fancy. So I put it in your drawer, the day that Mr. Douglas was due to stop by.
Sarah closed her eyes for a moment, picturing that dismal day. How distracted she'd been by her illness, giving Daisy the perfect opportunity to frame her.
Daisy was telling the truth.
Theo had known everything. She wished she could go back in time, to when she didn't know any of this, didn't suspect a thing. Go back to before the truth emerged. Theo had manipulated them both for his own purposes, treating Sarah like a marionette who was allowed out of her box, as long as she was of use. He'd played her for his own purposes, and she'd joyfully accepted whatever nonsense he'd thrown her way, taking it for love. Fury rose in her chest like a thick, polluted fog. The clanging of a prison door brought her back to the present.
Daisy, how could you have done this to me? I was your friend.
I'd made a promise to my mother we'd stay in the tenement. What were the little ones going to do when we were thrown out into the streets, into the cold? If you'd gone to the doctor with me at the beginning, it would have been finished up right off. You should have done as I said.
You're horrible.
A sharp laugh erupted from Daisy.
Don't pretend you were better than I was, having an affair, getting with child. We're the same.
No,
That's not true. She was about to say that she'd been in love, but Theo didn't deserve that. Why did you keep on stealing after you had me sent away? They said you'd gone back to England. I figured I'd held up my end of the deal. But Mr. Camden strung me along, promising a payment but never coming through. And I didn't have anything left to hold over him. I began pilfering small things here and there, enough to stave off the thugs. For all her hard edges, Sarah couldn't shake the ghost of the girl that Daisy had been. Eager to please, kind. Not this dirty, bitter urchin. Yet there was a time, near the end of her days in the asylum, when Sarah had been equally heartless. To herself, to others. Behind Daisy's vicious posturing was a profound sadness and loss. Where is your family now? The girl lowered her chin to hide it from wobbling. Don't know. Scattered. Lost. Daisy, you've done terrible things. But I am sorry that you ended up here, on this island. It's an awful place. I'm sorry you lost your family. The girl recovered fast, blasting Sarah with a garish smile. The gap in her teeth, black between cracked, dry lips. I hear the asylum is a fancy hotel compared to what we criminals put up with. You don't know anything, never did. Don't you pity me. I can take care of myself. The guard came in. Time's up. She grabbed Daisy by the back of the neck and shoved her out of the room in front of her. Daisy's cackling reverberated down the hallway after her. Sarah tore back to the ferry pier, breathing hard. Daisy. Theo. She was never to trust a soul again. Anyone might turn on you at any time. She might as well check back into the asylum for all life offered her. Let the nurses tell her when to eat, when to sleep. She didn't want to have to face each day the loss of everything she'd held dear. Her mother's suffering should have been warning enough, but Sarah had convinced herself that her own story would have a different ending. No such luck. Men betrayed, women endured. She had 40 minutes before the ferry departed. Lifting her skirt, she moved at a fast clip to the building where she and Natalia had peered in the window. She showed them Nellie's golden pass, and a nurse took down the relevant information. But he was born in the asylum. Does that make a difference? She asked. No. We have all records of every bairn here, dead or alive. The woman's Scottish brogue spoke the awful words with a melodic spin. Sarah waited, checking her timepiece, for 20 minutes. She couldn't leave without visiting the grave of her child, of saying a prayer over the mound of dirt that pressed upon his tiny bones. Finally, the nurse reappeared, holding a clipboard. A stillborn, you say? Yes, born in July of this year, to Sarah Smythe. No stillborn. The boy was alive. Well, then he was alive, but then he died. Arguing over the semantics cut her to the core. No, he was taken away, to the Foundling Asylum on Lexington and 68th. The room spun, and Sarah held hard to the wooden countertop to keep herself upright. He was alive. Why was I not told the truth? They never do, as a rule. No point in driving the nutters madder than they already are. Easier this way, I guess. During the ride across the river, Sarah keened on the hard bench, wishing the ferry would speed faster. So much time had already passed. Would he still be there? Was he still alive? She didn't know what she'd do when she found him, how to prove that the child was hers. Would they just give him to her, hand him over? She moaned, and the other passengers stared. The boy must have suffered so without his mother. Her baby was alive. Her thoughts wound around each other like a dust storm. More waiting, more sitting. The nurse in the Foundling Asylum was no kinder than the one on Blackwell's Island. They must turn brittle fast, in order to stay inured to the cries of the babies and children that echoed down the stairwell. A form was thrust at her on a clipboard. The words swum for a moment, before she focused, reading them softly out loud. The boy had been taken in by a family, just as Sarah was released from Blackwell's. She recognized the signature on the document, the same that she'd seen scrawled on countless letters and contracts. Theo had known all along. Christopher was her son.
Where is he?
Sarah tore down the long gallery of Theo's apartment. Her first priority was Christopher, getting him out of Theo's hands, taking him somewhere safe. She'd had plenty of time to figure out a plan on the ferry and cab ride back to the Dakota. First off, she'd head with Christopher to the offices of the New York World and tell Nellie everything. Nellie would protect them and provide them with safe shelter until Sarah could arrange to sail back to England. Only an ocean between herself and Theo would put her mind at ease. She'd planned on appearing calm, offering to take Christopher for a walk in the park, then absconding with him. But as she grew closer to the Dakota, panic gripped her. Once inside the apartment, the memories of everything Theo had said and done to her flooded back. The evening after the ball, the picnic, the betrayal. Mrs. Camden stepped out of the children's room, the three children scampering behind her. She saw the look on Sarah's face and turned around.
"Off you go, children. Play in the parlor, please."
The children trotted away quietly, no doubt tuned in to the strange vibrations that Sarah was giving off. Sarah barged into the nursery, Mrs. Camden close behind. Christopher was in his crib, asleep.
"Where is Theo?"
Sarah said.
"He's due back any minute. You seem upset. Let's sit down and have a cup of tea."
Sarah wanted to throttle her.
"You knew. You were raising my son and you knew it, didn't you? How did he get you to agree?"
Mrs. Camden didn't answer, but a tremble went through her body.
"Why would you do such a thing? Don't you have any shame?"
"He said I owed it to him."
"Owed it to him? You're as mad as he. He took my child. I want him back."
"He'll never let you do that." A child's wail pierced the standoff.
"Luther!"
Mrs. Camden ran to the library, and this time Sarah followed. Luther sat at Theo's desk, staring down at his open palm.
"My God, what's happened?" cried Mrs. Camden.
Sarah took the boy's hand in her own. It was unblemished, other than a small pinprick. Mrs. Camden knelt down.
"There, there."
As the child's cries died down to a dull whimper, Sarah looked around to find what had caused the injury. She reached down to pick up a letter opener that had fallen from the desk, and gasped. It was a knife, a sharp one with a curved blade. She'd seen it before. In the Rutherford's library.
"Where did you get this?"
she asked Luther. He pointed to an open drawer.
"Father usually keeps that locked," said Mrs. Camden. "How did you get into it?"
"I found the key in the top drawer," he mumbled. "I wanted to see if it fit. Then I saw the toy."
"My dear boy, you could have cut yourself terribly."
Mrs. Camden took the knife from Sarah and examined it.
"This is no toy. What on earth was it doing in Theo's desk?"
Sarah imagined Theo slipping it into his pocket at the ball, while he distracted her with his touch, taking whatever shiny object he wanted, just because he could. Angry at the men's dismissive insults about poor street children, wanting to strike back, feeling that everyone else owed him something. The front door opened. Theo. He stopped and surveyed the scene before him.
"What on earth is going on?"
He spoke cheerily, in a good mood. Sarah straightened. With the knowledge of the knife, she had leverage, She could threaten to turn him in if he didn't let her leave with Christopher.
Luther almost cut himself playing with this knife from your desk.
Mrs. Camden spoke with a harshness that Sarah had never heard before.
I told the boy not to play in here. Is he all right?
Luther, take your sisters and go to the nursery, ordered Mrs. Camden.
Shut the door.
The child scrambled away, calling out to Emily and Lula as he did. Theo patted Luther on the head as he ran by.
He seems fine. I'm sure there's no harm done.
Sarah pointed to the knife in Mrs. Camden's hand. What was that doing in your desk? For the first time since he'd arrived, Theo seemed off balance.
Right. It's a keepsake from an important night that I wanted to remember.
He gave her a pointed look. It's the Rutherford's knife. Sarah stood tall, firm, even though inside she was terrified. His audacity astonished her. You stole it. Mrs. Camden looked like she was about to pull her own hair out. She turned to Sarah.
What are you talking about?
We went to a ball. Together. The night before you arrived from England. I saw this knife there. It's part of the Rutherford's collection.
Don't be ridiculous.
Theo dismissed her with a wave of his hand.
It's not that at all.
She ignored his lies.
That's not the least you've done, is it? What do you mean?
I spoke with Daisy. She told me she tried to blackmail you, got me sent away, then you took my child. Her breath came haltingly. She couldn't speak any more than a few words at a time, and her emotions threatened to overpower her.
You saw Daisy? In prison?
Theo took a step forward, then stopped.
I don't know what to say. The girl's a crook.
She told me everything. His shoulders sagged, and he seemed more like a boy about to be reprimanded than a grown man. All bluster was gone.
I made a terrible mistake.
Yes, I remember you saying that, the day on the harbor. I didn't understand at the time. How could you do such a thing? He avoided his wife's gaze, directing his words at Sarah.
When Daisy told me that you were with child, I knew that everything might come crashing down. My business, my reputation. She said she would take care of it, and I thought that meant she'd bring you to a doctor.
She tried, said Sarah. You were a coward, trying to protect yourself. He pressed on.
But then there was that business with the necklace. I didn't know what to think, until Mr. Douglas informed me that you decided to go back to England voluntarily. At the time, I thought that was best, for all of us.
Sarah shook her head. Why would he lie to you?
Probably because, like me, he wanted everything tied up neatly, swept away, no hint of scandal. But after I read that terrible article in the paper, I realized that you were not in England. You'd been holed up in the madhouse all that time. The thought made me wretched. I realized what I'd set in motion, that it was my fault. Right away, I tracked down the reporter to find you.
You not only found me, but Christopher as well. I saw your signature, where you took him out of the foundling asylum. Sarah turned to Mrs. Camden. Did you know you've been raising my son?
I suspected.
She glowered at Theo. But I had no choice. He told me to take him in and never speak of the circumstances. How could you agree to such a thing? Sarah spun back to Theo. After trying to get rid of the child, why bother? Mrs. Camden's voice was bitter.
Because he was a boy.
Theo wanted a son. You already have Luther. A terrible silence fell over the room. The only sound the metallic ticking of the grandfather clock in the corner.
Tell her,
Theo instructed Mrs. Camden.
Go on. Tell her the truth.
Mrs. Camden flushed.
The twins were born when we were apart for a period of time. They are not Theo's.
The memories tumbled over in Sarah's mind. How Theo was less affectionate toward the twins than to Emily. The bruise on Luther's arm. The way Theo's own stepfather had mistreated him. And that day in the Langham hotel room, when the nanny had insisted Theo was supposed to be watching the twins, she'd been telling the truth. He'd gone out and left them alone in a room with an open window.
Theo paced the room, the words pouring out, like an actor practicing a soliloquy.
I'm not a terrible person. I made one mistake and it threatened to bring everything tumbling down. I was panicked. You see what my work means to me. You've been by my side the entire time. Half of it's yours, Sarah. You've earned it.
Money won't solve this problem, Theo.
It's not about the money. I'm creating something phenomenal. We're creating something phenomenal. And I want a son, a true son, to carry on my vision.
He looked up, tears in his eyes.
I figure I'll teach him everything I know, so he can carry on after I'm gone. I vow to take good care of him, and you, to set things right. If I'd known that was where Douglas was sending you, I would have swum across the East River to rescue you. Don't you see? I had a moment of terrible weakness, of panic. But then I tried to rectify it, to save both you and the boy.
Who is Luther and Lula's father, then?
Theo glanced at Mrs. Camden, who stood unblinking, furious.
She fell for some romantic poet who professed his love and then left her with child. Twins, no less.
Mrs. Camden began to shake, her shoulders trembling.
You're a beast! An unforgiving beast!
She appealed to Sarah.
I tried to get away with the children as much as possible. I didn't want to stay. The situation made me physically ill, but my choices were limited.
Before she'd known the truth, Sarah would have given anything to be Theo's wife, to be beside him day and night. Her toxic envy had made her blind to the truth. Mrs. Camden was still holding the knife, her grip fierce.
I was never bright enough for him. He brought me books and newspaper articles and insisted I read them, quizzed me on politics and Tolstoy, and I tried at first, but it was never enough.
When Sarah stayed mute, unsure of what to say, Mrs. Camden swiveled back to Theo, her fury at full pitch.
I could never please you. You never loved me, then punished me when I sought comfort elsewhere.
Calm down, Minnie.
Theo eyed her right hand.
Look at what I've done.
He gestured at the room around him.
I've taken care of you and your children. We live in this grand palace where you can get anything you like with a ring of a bell. We were both weak at times, but I finally succeeded. I kept both of our scandals out of the limelight. I have everything I want. Now both of you do too. It's a relief in a way.
Everything I want.
Mrs. Camden erupted.
I live with a tyrant across the sea from my country. My family is fractured, broken, and I can't even retreat to the safety of a private home. Instead, we live in this monstrosity where your lover lives down the hall and every tenant and servant knows that I am not enough, done in by the man who swore to love and protect me.
At first, Sarah thought Mrs. Camden was running out of the room, away from his venomous tone. But she was headed right for Theo, knife raised. He lifted up his hand as she approached, and for a second they looked as if they were about to begin some kind of macabre quadrille. Until she slashed at him hard, wildly. Sarah screamed for Mrs. Camden to stop, but at the sound of the knife cutting through flesh, she instinctively turned her head, sickened. Theo cried out, clutching one hand with the other, as blood seeped between his fingers and onto his white shirt, staining his waistcoat within seconds. Mrs. Camden pulled her arm back and lunged at him again, this time aiming for his chest.
Mrs. Camden, stop!
Sarah ran to her and wrenched the knife out of her hand. Theo fell sideways onto the drafting table. The entire structure crashed to the floor below him, pens scattered across the room as he landed on his stomach with a thud. His face turned to the side, mouth partly open. He blinked once, and then went still. Chapter 32. New York City. July, 1886. Still waiting. Biding time. But this was a different kind of waiting because there was no hope. And that was freeing in so many ways. In the past 8 months, Sarah had mastered the art of doing nothing, of letting her mind wander while her body sat still. Her mind could go anywhere it liked. Down the dark hallways of the Dakota, into the children's nursery, along the walkways of Central Park. She'd close her eyes and see the world outside, the one that she would never see again, only in her mind. Mind's eye. It was better than reality. If she tried hard enough, she could remember the scent of Christopher's baby breath, the sound of his cooing, the way he'd wiggled around inside her belly when they were one person. A bell rang. The door to her cell clanked open. Then she was walking down the cell block, to the jeers and yells that she usually could shut out. The cacophony of the incarcerated. She hadn't been sent back to Blackwell's after her trial. Instead, she'd been put on a wagon, shackled hand and foot, and carted 100 miles north of the city, to a prison in the woods. Sometimes Sarah revisited the day Mrs. Camden killed Theo, in her mind's eye. Where she'd gone wrong, if she could have made it right. But she'd been caught off guard by Mrs. Camden's attack. Then she'd made mistakes. After Theo had fallen, Sarah and Mrs. Camden had stared at each other for what seemed like ages, before Mrs. Camden began to shake, trembling as if she was about to fly off into the air and out the window. So Sarah took over. She told her to go to the children, close the door to the nursery while she figured out what to do, what to say. There was no way to make it look as if Theo had accidentally fallen on the knife. But the night with Daisy and the intruder came to mind. Yes, that would work. An intruder had broken in. They'd found him here, dead. She left the library, closing the doors behind her, and directed Mrs. Camden and the children to go up to the roof promenade. Take the stairs. Stay there. Don't come back down until I say so. Back in the library, the stolen knife lay in the very center of the rug, where Mrs. Camden had dropped it. That wouldn't do. It would raise too many questions. She slipped it into the pocket of her dress and walked downstairs, through the courtyard and into the park, where she buried it beneath a thicket of bushes. No one must find it. Back inside, past the porters who gaped at her and asked if she were all right. She caught her reflection in the apartment's foyer mirror, noticing for the first time that her skirt and her cheek were stained red, as if she'd been out picking raspberries. Theo lay in a pool of blood, his mouth open, face white. A glint of metal caught her eye, lying on a litter of linen drawings splattered with blood. The knife's sheath. In her haste, she'd missed it. And next to it, a ghastly stump of a finger, covered in blood. She picked up the sheath and dropped it into one of the leather tubes that held drawings, drawings that would no longer come to fruition. All of Theo's ideas, buildings, lost. The finger was soft, still warm. He'd drawn masterpieces with it, the sure, even lines issuing from the nub of the pen and its clasp. She had an irrational desire to put it back on his hand, to try to make him whole again. At a loss, she placed it in the tube as well, closing the lid tightly. The tube went back under his desk. She'd tell Mrs. Camden to dispose of it later. Voices in the hallway. Men's voices. The door to the apartment opened. She'd locked it behind her, but Fitzroy had the master key. He and two policemen stepped inside. Carefully, politely, like they didn't want to make a fuss, didn't want to muss up the silk rug and shiny floorboards. Not expecting to see blood and mess and a body. A woman in a dress with red stains on it.
red stains on her hands and face.
Fitzroy spoke for her when she didn't answer any of their questions. Her name, who she was, who Theo was. That he didn't know where the rest of the family was.
One policeman had rushed off to search the other rooms, fearful at what he might find.
No, she wanted to say. Everyone else is safe. It's just Theo who's dead. And Sarah, who was red. Red with blood.
Sarah.
She was in the visitor's room of the prison, not sure how she'd gotten here, not remembering the walk from her cell to here.
Mrs. Camden stood before her. She looked pale and thin, not good. She had to stay healthy for the children, for Christopher. She'd promised.
I'm sorry it took so long to come. I didn't want the newspapers to know. I had to wait.
Of course.
They sat down on either side of a small wooden table. Once, Daisy had been the one in shackles and Sarah had been free. Theo had brought everyone down with him that he possibly could. But not Mrs. Camden, nor the children. Sarah had made sure they were all right.
How is Christopher?
Her voice creaked from disuse. Mrs. Camden smiled.
He's lovely. We celebrated his first birthday 2 weeks ago. Growing fast, healthy, a good boy. You have a good boy.
Sarah nodded. She rarely spoke these days. Figuring out which words to say took too much effort.
Sarah, I should have confessed.
Mrs. Camden looked about the room, her eyes red and wet.
I should be here, not you. I should have taken the blame. You did nothing. Nothing at all. No. We agreed when you came to see me before the trial. It's better that Christopher is raised by you. I wouldn't have been able to give him everything you have. Such a chance at a grand life. I will. I promise.
She trailed off. Blinded by love. The phrase had always seemed silly to Sarah, something poets invented. Yet nothing could have prepared her for the devotion she'd felt for Theo. He'd enveloped her in his intellect and his charm, making her feel she was an indispensable part of his life. And maybe she had been, for a time. He had needed her around, as a reflection of all the good qualities of himself, because his wife, by that time, reflected the worst. His irritability, his spite, and his thirst for success. Sarah had refused to see the shadows in his temperament, or question why his relationship with Mrs. Camden was so strained. Most likely he'd lavished similar attention on Mrs. Camden early in their relationship, before turning on her when she failed to live up to his high standards. But these regrets were no longer of consequence. The boy was what mattered most, and she was determined he be given every chance in the world to succeed, independent of the sordid story of his parentage.
Did you find the drawing in my room?
Mrs. Camden took out a handkerchief and dabbed at her eyes.
I've hung it over his crib, as you asked. It's the first thing he sees when he wakes, and before he goes to sleep each night.
Her dream cottage. So her child might also dream of lovely things. For all of Theo's betrayals, he'd left behind many beautiful creations, including the drawing. And their son.
What about my letter? You have my letter. It's in a safe place, and I promise to give it to Christopher when he turns 21. Then he'll know everything, and he can come and visit you.
Sarah smiled. That was 20 years from now. She wouldn't be around. She could feel it in her bones. Something inside her was eating away at her. Guilt, maybe. Anger at having been so misused. Anger at herself. Her insides were a stewy, nasty mess, and would kill her eventually. Nothing more needed to be said on the subject. They had an agreement. Mrs. Camden spoke of Christopher and Luther and the girls, telling her what they'd said and did, the words he spoke, the way he wobbled about on his fat little legs. Sarah drank in every word, every image, to fill her library of thoughts for later use. She would feed on them until the next visit, until her energy faded and her soul dissipated into the night air. Her last remembrance was that of holding her boy in his sailor suit, on top of the roof promenade of the Dakota, the city gleaming below her.
Chapter 33, New York City, September 1986. A year after Strawberry Fields was officially dedicated, the hilltop had become a hive of activity most hours of the day, the gray and white Imagine mosaic strewn with flowers and candles. To be honest, Bailey avoided the area if she could. It wasn't a place she felt comfortable striding through, veering around the tourists wielding cameras. Doing so was like galloping through the Sistine Chapel to get to St. Peter's. Covered in a canopy of American elm tree branches and lined with hollies and mountain laurel, the site demanded an air of reverence and respect. She found a spot on an open bench vacated by a couple of college students in torn jeans carrying backpacks. Red roses had been arranged in a peace symbol, and three guitarists sat together on a bench opposite, strumming out tunes to a receptive crowd. She watched as a little girl danced about, jumping and swinging her arms to the beat, unaware of the tragedy behind the music. 1 year sober. She'd made it. Not only had she made it, she'd risen to the challenge, supporting others at meetings, newcomers who came in weeping and scared, or those who'd relapsed and walked in amid a cloud of self-hatred. Each time she'd helped someone else, she couldn't help but reanalyze her own journey and mark her own progress, remember what it was like, and vow to stay healthy and strong. Soon after the insanity in Fred's office, Bailey had reached out to Melinda. She hated the way things had ended, and could only imagine what it felt like for Melinda to have lost everything, to be cast out from her own family history. To make Melinda suffer had not been her goal. So Bailey and Jack had offered to buy the Dakota apartment from Melinda and Manville. Melinda had demanded a princely sum, which they'd gladly paid, hoping it would bring Melinda some peace and help Manville's outsider artists. From what Bailey had heard, Melinda was on a rampage these days, partying hard in her white brick condo on the east side. Bailey had called several times, trying to make amends and explain her actions, but Melinda refused to return her calls. With time, Bailey hoped, they might be able to renew their friendship, but on more equal footing. But if not, at least Bailey had tried. She checked her watch. It wasn't like Renzo to be late. Then again, it wasn't like Renzo to ask to meet in the most touristy spot on the Upper West Side. Usually they wandered around the park's reservoir, comparing demanding clients and tenants. His advice was invaluable, and he'd even stopped by her latest project a few times to offer a second opinion when the electrician or plumber came in with a bid that seemed high. Together, Renzo and Bailey had restored the Dakota apartment to its original grandeur. Gone were the bamboo poles and sponge-painted walls, and in their place stood the original architectural details, down to the cast-iron wash basins and solid brass hardware. She'd held an open house for the other tenants once the work was done, spurring requests for her expertise. In a year, she'd become the go-to interior designer for the restoration of townhouses, penthouses, and pre-war apartments around Manhattan, a niche that separated her from the pack of postmodernists like Tristan. The fact that she'd repaid Tristan in full for her time at Silver Hill had helped ease her re-entry in the design community considerably. Theodore Camden would have been pleased, she hoped. Sarah Smythe as well. Fred had dug further into the family's records and discovered that Minnie died suddenly of the flu in 1900, which explained why Christopher never got the letter or the annuity. Sarah, meanwhile, had passed away in prison from some kind of cancer, a few years after being sentenced. Bailey was glad she and Jack finally knew some concrete details about their family's past, no matter how lurid. Knowing that Minnie Camden had attempted to take care of Christopher financially had gone a long way to ease her father's mind. Once the trust money was transferred over, Jack scooped up the lot next door and doubled the size of his auto repair shop and bought a boat of his own.
"Simple pleasures,"
he'd said one day after taking her and Renzo out for a cruise. So many unknowns, though. But, as Fred had said, some things were simply lost to history. Renzo appeared on the far side of the plaza. He smiled at her and gave a little wave. She waved back. Then her mouth dropped open. By his side was a puppy with a fluffy, apricot-colored coat and big brown eyes. It mouthed the leash as it walked along beside Renzo, before a rose lying in the mosaic caught the dog's eye and it scooped it up, holding it in its jaws like a Spanish tango dancer. The dog trotted up to Bailey with the relaxed, happy expression of an animal to whom everything was either a plaything or a treat. She reached down and gently extricated the rose. "This is the surprise?" She patted its head and laughed as the puppy tried to gum her hand.
"Yes. I'd like to introduce you to my new best friend, Eleanor Rigby. Who will go by Rigby, as Eleanor is a little too 19th century for my taste."
"I wholeheartedly agree." Bailey reached down and scooped her up and placed her on her lap. "She's adorable."
"Hopefully she'll settle down and won't chew up the baseboards."
"You have your work cut out for you. How fitting that this is where I learn that I'll be displaced as your best buddy. Very kind of you to break it to me in this peaceful environment."
"Right."
He sat on the bench beside her. Rigby stopped squirming and lay down on Bailey's knees, entranced by a group applauding the musicians.
"I was thinking about that."
"You were?"
"I figured that maybe you were due a promotion from best friend. After all, it's been a year since you've been sober, hasn't it?"
Renzo knew well and good that it had been a year. He'd been at the meeting last night, beaming with pride, when she'd shared her story. In fact, the last few months had been a sublime agony, the two of them not even holding hands in a concerted effort to wait the year out in its entirety. "It certainly has. What kind of promotion were you thinking? Bestest friend, perhaps?" She couldn't help but tease, because she knew what was coming as well as he did. They'd been friends and confidants for longer than each had believed possible, and the time had come. Thank God, because she didn't think she'd be able to wait much longer. He leaned in and kissed her softly on the mouth. It felt right, perfect and sweet. Until another tongue broke in, Rigby attempting to join in the action. They broke apart, laughing, wiping their mouths, as the guitarist broke into the chorus of "In My Life." As if hypnotized by the music, the puppy settled down, and Renzo sang along quietly, softly, in Bailey's ear to the very end. Author's note. The address is a blend of historical fact and fiction, and I took a couple of liberties that Gilded Age enthusiasts will surely catch. The Statue of Liberty arrived in New York in the summer of 1885, not the fall, and Nellie Bly went undercover at Blackwell's Island Insane Asylum in 1887. The Rutherford's mansion is loosely based on William and Alva Vanderbilt's, and Theo's speech is drawn from Edward Clark's 1879 speech to the West End Association. Several books provided inspiration, including Stephen Birmingham's Life at the Dakota, Andrew Alpern's The Dakota, A History of the World's Best-Known Apartment Building, Elizabeth Hawes's New York, New York, How the Apartment House Transformed the Life of the City, 1869 to 1930, Nellie Bly's 10 Days in a Madhouse, and Tessa Bowes's The Housekeeper's Tale, The Women Who Really Ran the English Country House. Thanks to all the experts who helped flesh out my research, any errors are my own.
We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of The Address by Fiona Davis.
read by Saskia Marleveld and Brittany Presley. This program was directed by Simone Barros. Executive producer, Kelly Gilday. Text copyright 2017 by Fiona Davis. Production copyright 2017, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.